Recently, medical experts from across the country gathered in Des Moines to examine the unique healthcare challenges faced by the LGBT community. This hour, we hear from several of them. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. If you're gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender, there's a good chance you've had a doctor flinch or flounder through an appointment. Today, we learn how medical professionals can become more LGBT inclusive. Are you a member of the LGBT community? Do you have a doctor's office experience to share or a question to ask? Join our discussion this hour. First, this news. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. If you're gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender, there's a good chance you've had a doctor flinch or flounder through an appointment with you. This past Saturday, Des Moines University hosted a health and wellness conference focused on the needs of gays, lesbians, bisexual, and transgender people. And medical experts from across the country came. They gathered to examine the unique healthcare challenges faced by the LGBT community. And we have three participants from that conference with us this hour to discuss what's different about the medical needs of this community and how medical professionals might better meet those needs. Are you gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender? What are your questions about the health care specific to the LGBT community? We'd like to have you join our conversation this hour. Perhaps you have an experience to share with a medical professional that you felt was wanting. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Joining us for the entire hour, a familiar voice, let's say, because it's radio. Dr. Richard Deming is with us, radiation oncologist and medical director of the Mercy Cancer Center in Des Moines. Also, full disclosure, a longtime underwriter of Iowa Public Radio. Dr. Deming, welcome back to our program.
Thanks, Ben. It's great to be here.
Also with us this first half hour, he has to be away a little bit earlier, Dr. Stephen Nelson. He's a pediatric hematologist and director of the Sickle Cell Clinic at the Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota. Joining us by phone, Dr. Nelson, welcome to you.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Deming, tell us a little bit more about this conference so that we're all on the same page here. Perhaps you can tell us, I think this conference is in its fourth year. Why is there the need for such a conference focused on LGBT health? Isn't their health just like anyone else's health?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, Ben. I was asked to participate this year to comment on the importance of physician-patient relationships. And you're exactly right. That's a important concept of healthcare that isn't really paid enough attention to, and that really is across the board. In terms of the LGBT issues, I think that from my perspective as a physician engaging in trusting, caring, authentic relationships and taking care of patients, it's how do physicians take the time to understand a cultural difference, understand where the patient is coming from, and how to provide the best possible care in a patient-centric way by focusing on the importance of the relationship between the provider and the patients. And that comes with understanding. And from my perspective, it comes from a compassionate perspective on the part of the physician.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Stephen Nelson, as a physician, how did you get interested in this specific area of LGBT health?
Yes, well, for me, it started several years ago looking at health equity across several demographics, not just sexuality, but race, poverty, those social determinants of health. For me, the start was I take care of kids with sickle cell disease, which, although it's a global disorder, it's an inherited disorder of the red blood cell. It's a global disorder, but in North America, virtually all of the patients are black as a result of the Atlantic slave trade. And I began to notice, you know, our patients all have very different stories, like all of our families do, but they all have one thing in common, that none of them is white, and the vast majority of the healthcare team is, and how that could affect, as Dr. Deming said, our relationship building, our compassion, our humanism, our preconceived unconscious biases around issues of race. And that's also potentially an issue around issues of sexuality and LGBT issues, and how a provider, how those biases may affect our ability to connect with the patient and affect our decision making.
Mm-hmm. So give us some examples. You are white. Tell us how these biases may creep into the way you treat children at your clinic, unless you're aware of them.
Yeah, and some of it, you're right, there are unconscious, right, implicit biases and explicit biases. And I think what happens is we, you know, our unconscious biases are rooted in stereotyping, which we all do, and some of that is based on the narratives that wash over us. And especially in healthcare, because we tend to be under heavy cognitive load, right? We're very busy. We've got rooms full of patients. We have other demands upon our time, the electronic medical record and other issues. And our schedules are ripe for defaulting to stereotyping. And we like to categorize people, right? And if we can get our answer more quickly, then it's more efficient. And it takes hard work to identify that we are functioning at the level of our unconscious biases and to really stop that process. It's not easy.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Deming, comment on that, because if you're a doctor, it's easy to get into the listening to what the patient has as far as symptoms and then searching for which category, sickness that person fits, right?
Sure.
And so that's in a way, what are we saying here, that we have to include more than that?
Well, we have to be aware of what we don't know. I think all of those attributes of characterization and sort of pigeonholing our knowledge is a shorthand way of remembering some facts and knowledge, and isn't inherently bad. But we have to be aware that we don't really know. And I think that one of the attributes of a caring, compassionate physician is sort of this Buddhist concept of not knowing. You know, over time, we have collected an amazing amount of facts, and we have this knowledge. But what patients really need of us is the wisdom and not just the knowledge. And going into an interview with a patient for the first time, no matter how much we might think we know based on the name, on the demographics, on even the diagnosis that might be written there, to go into the interview with this concept of not knowing, to be curious, to be attentive, to listen attentively before speaking, those are all attributes that bring out the real story behind the demographics that we always lead whenever we do a write-up, we always sort of start off with the age and the racial and the quick demographics. But every person's story is much deeper than that, and it's listening first attentively that sets the framework of the authentic, trusting, compassionate relationship.
Dr. Nelson, may I ask, how many years have you been a practicing MD?
23 years here at Children's.
You've seen a lot of change. That's why I ask that. I'm sure when we talk about sexual orientation, sexual identity, so is that now something that a doctor is expected to find out about, along with age, weight, and gender, and so forth? Is that always important to find out, or some patients more forthcoming than others, and how is that dealt with?
I think it's always important to find out, and unfortunately, there's still not a lot of training in medical schools and nursing schools around issues of bias and humanism and connection, as Dr. Deming is talking about, and cultural humility is one way to think about that. And that certainly holds true with LGBT issues. But it is very important, and as a pediatrician, you know, there are some, I think, unique issues with children and adolescents around this topic is learning how to ask the questions, like, modifying our interview with the potential of the child maybe struggling with their, gender identity or their sexual orientation, and learning how to do that in a safe way.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me an example of how you would question a youth about that, a teenager about that, if you thought it was relevant to making a good diagnosis and treatment?
Yeah, and I think it's probably always relevant when we get to the part of an interview with an adolescent where we're trying to look for certain risk factors. And there are unique risk factors for gay and lesbian and transgender youth, specifically mental health issues and suicide risk. So there are always questions that are asked when the parent is outside of the room, right? We ask about their home environment. We ask about their peer groups. We ask about their activities, sports and things. We want to talk about dating issues, and then having sex and risk for pregnancy if applicable, and sexually transmitted illnesses, and then suicide risk. So the way to ask those questions needs to be done in an accepting way. And I, back to the sort of stereotyping, I have to be conscious about if I have a 16-year-old boy, to not just automatically ask, do you have a girlfriend, right? Mm-hmm. And not just assuming. Don't assume. Ask, are you dating anyone? And you can ask, are you dating boys, girls, or both, for example.
Right. And it's important here, too, because that question that a doctor may seem as just a perfectly normal question, conventional question here, may carry with it, part of our cultural stigma that we have against certain groups here.
Absolutely.
And what you mentioned before, connect the dots there too, because if you feel a stigma connected with your sexual identity coming from your doctor, how does that connect with potentially self-hurt, depression, even suicide, mental health?
Exactly. And if you don't feel safe discussing these very important these are health-related issues. If you're not feeling comfortable discussing that with your provider, it's certainly a lost opportunity. So just little things, even little things in the waiting room, even wearing like a little rainbow on your stethoscope, or there's some things that can be done in the physical space of the clinic or whatever the healthcare setting is to make it feel more welcoming, and just asking the questions in an open way and just not assuming.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Deming, you've been in practice for well over 30 years. I wonder if you have a sense of how comfortable you think most physicians are in dealing with LGBT health issues and in having the sensitivity that Dr. Nelson just described.
Yes, listening to Dr. Nelson, there certainly are generational issues here. I grew up in South Dakota in the 50s, and we did not have much cultural diversity in South Dakota. And back in the 60s and 70s, one did not openly talk about LGBT issues. I got a education in that aspect when I did my residency during the HIV crisis in San Francisco in the 1980s. And the difference between the openness to discussion of gender issues in San Francisco in the 1980s compared to growing up in South Dakota in the 60s and 70s and medical school in the 1970s in Nebraska was huge. And part of it is a comfort with the discussion, the openness, the ability to just realize it's a part of a natural conversation. And it's the listening attentively and accepting with acceptance. If you can't have that acceptance in this sacred space that we have between a physician and a patient, then where are you going to find that? And it, I think, is something that those of my generation have come to out of experience with compassion, with reflection, with just the humanism that happens in interpersonal relationships, and then being willing, in the context of a patient-physician relationship to listen without judgment and to be accepting. As you know, I'm a cancer doctor, and a lot of when you're a cancer physician, even if you're dealing with a very early stage cancer that's highly curable, death is present in the room from the very beginning. The word cancer really brings out this fear of mortality. And almost every conversation, whether it's a person with highly curable cancer or a patient you have that does not have a curable cancer, the sacred nature of this relationship and the importance of trust as you agree to be on this journey that may end up in death, and to be able to be present with the patient and the family. You need to know not only about them as individuals, but who are their support system, who cares for them, how to bring them into the conversation and the journey as well.
Stephen Nelson, Dr. Yeah. Nelson, as a pediatrician, you mentioned racial disparities as a way of bringing you to interest in LGBT health issues as well. I wonder, when you look at the racial disparities and how they surface in a medical setting and then LGBT issues, how do you compare the two? Is the divide greater for race than for LGBT, or how are they different when you compare them?
Yeah, I mean, I think they are somewhat different, and some of it depends geographically, but certainly in our country as a whole, but also in Iowa and Minnesota, the gap looking at certain social determinants of health, so things like homelessness, your median income, education, insurance rates, educational attainment, those discrepancies between Iowans and Minnesotans of color and white Iowans and Minnesotans is quite high. But there are some significant similarities because with LGBT issues, it's not isolated to one race. If you look at homelessness, actually, fully a third of homeless youth identify as LGBT. So there are some similarities, and it's difficult sometimes to separate issues of class and race and income and race. I think those are inextricably linked. But I think the issues are similar in a sense about discrimination and bullying. You can certainly look at data in the schools, the rate of bullying by different demographics, language, race, sexual orientation, LGBT issues. And although the rates are much higher for high school students that are LGBT, kids of color are not far behind. And on that note, it's interesting that it's really about perceptions. The majority of students who report bullying around issues of sexuality or gender identity do not self-identify as being a part of the LGBT community. So it really is about the perceptions of the public.
Dr. Nelson, I know you have to leave our conversation in just a couple minutes.
Yeah.
If I could give you one last question here, because you are a pediatrician. Of course, you're dealing with minors often, this must be a very tricky area because you have parents who are perhaps unaware of their child's sexual identity or aware of it or more or less accepting of it.
That theme of parental acceptance or lack thereof really ties very closely to the mental health of the child and adolescent well into adulthood.
And it must make it very tricky.
Makes it very tricky, and there was a lot of discussion at the conference, and Dr. Deming touched on it, about certainly about compassion from the provider standpoint, but also a lot of discussion about advocacy and self-advocacy, and as a patient, as an LGBT patient, speaking up for what you need, demanding respect, those kind of things, which absolutely I would encourage. But it's tricky when you're 15, right, or you're a minor, and how do you, how do you make that dance? And, we do spend time alone with the adolescent. That is standard practice. not just because we might be concerned about a sexuality issue. And, you know, we tailor our interview to make it a safe space. And certainly in our electronic medical record at Children's, there are sections that are private, that, you know, everyone now has the parent portal and access to things. There are, you know, sections of the child's chart that are not accessible to the parent. And as a pediatrician, as you say, it's a fine line, but ultimately we are the child's advocate. And we need to do that in a family-centered way, but ultimately we are the child's advocate.
Okay, Dr. Stephen Nelson, we'll let you go now. Thank you very much.
I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you for being generous with your time. Dr. Stephen Nelson, a pediatric hematologist, director of the Sickle Cell Clinic, the Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota, and a participant in the conference this past weekend in Des Moines. Thank you, Dr. Nelson.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Dr. Deming, we have a couple minutes before we go to break here. What would you like to add at this point? We're going to have another guest join us in the next half hour. What comes to mind on the heels of what Dr. Nelson said, perhaps?
Yeah, he's an amazing individual, and the perspective he brings as a pediatrician, especially in adolescent medicine, is a perspective that I honestly don't have. And when you think about the issues related to the parents and the acceptance, it really gives a lot of food for thought. My real interest is talking about, you know, the acceptance between the patient and the physician, and mm-hmm. also the importance of that relationship to outcomes. There's a lot of research that's going on now around compassionate care. And not only is it the right thing to do from a humanitarian point of view, but there's an emerging body of evidence that compassionate care actually improves outcomes, improves patient satisfaction, and even can reduce healthcare costs.
Mm-hmm. Well, give us briefly an example of that, because some might not understand, say, well, my doctor asks about my symptoms and gives me a treatment for that. That's what I call compassion. But you mean something different, don't you?
Yeah, I do. So a case I saw last week. So it was a woman in her early 90s who had recently been diagnosed with a recurrence of lung cancer. And so I'm a cancer doctor. I do cancer treatments, and I go in to see the patient, and I know the basics before I walk into the room, that this is a woman, and I know her age, and I know her diagnosis, and I'm a cancer doctor, and I can treat cancer, and I walk in, and I start the conversation like I do with every patient. I ask them about themselves, where they're from, share a little bit about where I'm from, and let them know that I really care about them as a person. In this particular patient, as we're getting into then the story, because every patient is a story, and I like to sort of begin at the beginning and the beginning of their cancer story, because most patients, when they come to see me, already have a diagnosis. So we're going through the story, and then I start talking about the options for treatment. And I know from the physician who had called me and sent her to me that there's a particular type of treatment that I do that she may benefit from, and I start going into that, and she sort of says, well, wait a minute, what if I don't want treatment? Mm-hmm. And I said, that's a very good point. Let me just back up. You're the boss. I work for you. So before I start talking more about the treatment, tell me, what do you think about your cancer, and what are the things going through your mind? So it became less of a talk about treatment and more of a conversation about where she was on this journey.
That's a beautiful story. Dr. Richard Deming, radiation oncologist and medical director of the Mercy Cancer Center in Des Moines. And we'll continue with Dr. Deming after we have a short break, as we talk about a recent conference last Saturday, as a matter of fact, that dealt with LGBT health issues. Would you like to join us with your question or comment? 1-866-780-9100. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This past Saturday, Des Moines University hosted a health and wellness conference that focused on the needs of gays, lesbians, bisexual, and transgender people. We're talking about that this hour. The themes of it go far broader than just that group, though we do have that group in our focus. And if you'd like to join our conversation, What are your questions, your concerns about health care specific to the LGBT community? 1-866-780-9100. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. With us the entire hour, Dr. Richard Deming. He was a participant in the conference, radiation oncologist and medical director of the Mercy Cancer Center in Des Moines. Also joining us this half hour, Ryan Salins is an activist in the transgender community. He speaks, consults, and writes about LGBT issues in healthcare and also in the workplace. Ryan Salins, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
So I wonder if it'd be best to start off by having you perhaps share a little bit of your personal story of gender transition.
Well, so 11 years ago, I was 25 years old and standing in a bookstore in Boston, Massachusetts, where I found a book about transgender men, so people who were born assigned female and had transitioned to male. And my journey up to that point was one with a lot of struggle with body image, a struggle with an eating disorder, struggling with coming out first as lesbian and recognizing my attraction to women, and then finally finding this book and understanding that a lot of the struggles in my life were really truly linked to the fact that my gender identity was different than my biological sex.
So tell us a little bit about what you remember most in this transition, about the medical help that you received at the time, or perhaps medical help that could have been better had there been a greater understanding of the transgender community.
The medical help that I received, I would say that for the most part, the people that in a way, agreed to work with me because in many cases, I was the first transgender person they worked with. In many cases, it was very positive. However, it was also very frustrating and very scary for me because you didn't know how much the provider or even the frontline staff knew about what it meant to be transgender. You didn't know if they were going to be using the right name or right pronoun with you. And you didn't know if they even actually knew the proper steps of how to take care of you, whatever those needs are, whether it be hormone therapy or a certain surgical procedure to help align your body with your mind. So there's a lot of anxiety in thinking about my past and my experiences with medical providers.
Mm-hmm. So what messages? You spoke a couple of times, I think, at this conference. What messages did you bring to the healthcare providers who were gathered?
The first message is just having an awareness of the inequalities that impact transgender individuals that will bring about unique healthcare needs that even move beyond the transition, to really look into our role in healthcare to see what messages we're sending all of our clients around our acceptance and openness in serving them, and what assumptions or stereotypes do we use to try to lead our conversations or how we treat clients. So just really being aware of that and being able to take a step back to really serve each client on a case-by-case basis and to listen to their needs and not to assume that for one transgender patient that you serve, not assuming that their needs are going to be the same needs that the next transgender patient has coming into your exam room.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an example of wording you've heard, an approach to an interview that could have been better? An example of what you're just talking about when a healthcare provider may not even be aware that the wording was somehow a problem.
Well, I'll give you actually a very personal example. It happened to me actually last year. I was going to a spine surgeon to have my spine looked at through the MRI due to a disc problem that I was having. And I generally do not out myself as transgender on the forms that I fill out when working with a provider because I don't know where that information is going, and I don't know what the knowledge set is of the people that have that information. So I did, however, on this particular form, circle that I've had a mastectomy to have my chest surgery, and then also I had a hysterectomy. And the reason I did that is because I knew they were doing an MRI, and pelvic girdles are different for biological male bodies versus biological female bodies. And so, like, if they're looking at this, I don't want them to be alarmed. Well, when the PA was looking over my information, he saw that I had circled both of those surgical procedures, and he questioned me, like, oh, you've had a hysterectomy and mastectomy? But kind of like, did you know that you just circled this? And I just responded simply by saying, yes, I'm trans. and that's it. And then he further responded by saying, oh, bless your heart, which I'm not really quite sure what that means, but it was a little bit awkward, and I could tell that he was a little bit confused and uncomfortable in that moment.
Interesting. Dr. Deming, you're listening to that story. Yeah. That's something that happens in medical offices all around the country.
It does. You know, so maybe a comment, and then I'd have a question for Ryan.
Sure.
So my comment would be, so I have had transgender patients, and since it is an unusual situation out of the ordinary, it does. You know, you remember that. I would say, though, in all fairness, the first time I have a patient from a particular country in Africa, or somebody who is unusual in a different way, maybe a dwarf, or somebody who has exceptional height, that there are some exceptions that are just worthy of noting. And for those of us who don't work all the time in the LGBT community, the noting it as being unusual isn't meant to be calling attention in a bad way. It's just some of the ways that we respond to an unusual situation. And one of the things that we need to do as caregivers, and what we need to do as we train doctors, is to teach about cultural sensitivity and openness and acceptance, but it's not to eradicate the differences. The first time I used the word transgender in one of my dictations, I remember that quite well. It was a patient, not unlike Ryan, that had been born with female genitalia, but now identifies himself as a man. And the malignancy that we were dealing with was a malignancy of the female genitalia, but the name and the gender and everything was associated with a male, but yet it was associated with a female malignancy. And as I then just got to know the individual and know him well and accepting, as I try to do the dictation and conform it to sort of the normal way we as physicians, this is a 62-year-old male, female, transgender, it wasn't terminology that trips off the tongue for a 62-year-old physician who hasn't been working in the LGBT community. So I look back at my dictations, and what I started off doing was talking about, the XY, XX, and then it really dawned on me that this is where the first time I used then the transgender word in the kind of the beginning of the dictation that would clearly summarize that what we're dealing with, because it is confusing when the gender and the sexual identity don't match up and you're talking about physical disorders that have to do with the genitalia.
Interesting. Ryan, I wonder, given your experience here and the fact that you're speaking before medical professionals here, do you have in mind what type of training, how this is best incorporated into the comprehensive training that doctors receive in this country?
Well, first, the ideal situation to happen would be to look at our schools and to start to develop comprehensive curriculum on serving the LGBTQ community as a whole, so that our upcoming doctors and providers are actually given a decent amount of time to be trained on the unique healthcare needs of LGBTQ people. And then the second would be looking at continuing education hours and how we can incorporate in continuing education hours training that's specific to LGBTQ clients and to make it mandatory. And again, when you're LGBTQ, we talk about the unique healthcare needs. It's not because people that are LGBT have different needs simply because they're LGBT. We have different needs because of the experiences of discrimination and stigma that we have in society. So the way that society treats LGBTQ people increases the probability of them having healthcare needs that their counterparts may not.
For instance, when we talked in the first half hour, Ryan, you weren't with us, but that stigma can lead to a lot of stress, mental health problems, depression, and even worse.
Correct. So minority stress theory is what is applied to the LGBTQ community. And with the minority stress theory, we look at, one, the external factors that impact LGBTQ people around non-acceptance of their identity, around politicians creating laws to try to continue further discriminating against the LGBT community. And then you look at the internalized messaging that people start receiving because they don't feel like they fit in, because they don't feel like they're accepted, whether it be within their family, their community, or even their religious organization. So both of these compounds that lead to the mental health disparities of anxiety, depression, which further then can lead to your suicide, victimization, and substance abuse.
If you've just joined our conversation this hour on River to River, we're talking about health care and health issues specific to the LGBT community. Ryan Salins was the gentleman just talking, an activist in the transgender community, speaks, writes, and consults about LGBT issues on health care, also issues in the workplace. Also with us, Dr. Richard Deming, director of the Mercy Cancer Center in Des Moines. Both were participants in a conference that looked at this past weekend. From our listener, Shayla in Decorah, this question and this experience. I'm from a small town, and when I first started to question my sexuality, I wanted to talk to my healthcare provider about it. But my doctor, however, was my dad's best friend at the time. Even though HIPAA would have mandated confidentiality, I didn't trust that my questions would be kept confidential. I felt like the only way to be anonymous would have been to drive an hour away to see a doctor, something that was a huge hassle at the time. Is the state providing counseling and education for doctors who have been practicing for a long time, might be older and less understanding about gay rights? So I think there's a couple of things here. Ryan, here we've got an urban, rural divide here, and also a demographic. An older set of doctors is less likely to be in tune with LGBT issues.
Yes. My heart goes out to the listener that sent in her experience, and she's bringing up a very common thread that impacts LGBT people, not even necessarily in rural areas, but also urban, even though we'll see an increase, though, in the rural areas. Will my information be protected and safe if it's shared with a provider? You would hope with guidance that, again, HIPAA would protect individuals and medical confidentiality would protect individuals. But especially in small towns, sometimes a little bit more loose with looking at those guidelines and that framework. So we hope that that will change and that more medical providers will actually learn how to talk with each client about medical confidentiality even before they begin with the exam, so that people do know and can be assured that what is shared with their provider in the room stays in the room and it's not shared outside of it.
Dr. Deming, since we've had such a cultural shift on LGBT issues here, what are your thoughts about counseling and training the older set of medical professionals in our state?
Yeah, I think that the listener brings up an important issue in terms of a generational divide. I can tell you, going to medical school in the late 1970s, I had zero training on the particular needs of LGBT community. We didn't even use that term back then. I really applaud the medical schools such as DMU that did this conference. And I know that this isn't just a once a year, one day conference, but that medical schools now are much more in tune to cultural sensitivity, to gender sensitivity, to not only teaching students how to be accepting and compassionate in their care, but also providing the knowledge and factual information that allows new physicians to be more prepared to be physicians for LGBT community. There are opportunities for those of us who trained in an earlier time and place to to become more aware. And I think it's incumbent upon all of us to understand where our patients are coming from, to know the most we can about them. The most important thing, I think, for those of us who maybe haven't gone through particular training, but through the work we do, we obviously take care of the LGBT community, is to be accepting, to understand, to gain the knowledge we can. One of the questions I was going to ask of Ryan is how much he feels it's his personal responsibility or desire to help inform those people he comes in contact with, especially in the medical community, who may be from a generation where they don't have the background education. I learn a lot from my patients, and I think a good physician is open to the fact that a physician can learn from the patient just as the patient can learn from the physician.
Ryan?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, I find myself kind of wearing two different hats when it comes to healthcare and advocacy for the community. On the one end, where I am the educator, it's always my mission to help inform and to educate, and then also be able to bring in some personal anecdotes and personal stories to give examples for healthcare providers. But I can say I feel that I'm placed in a little bit of a different role when I am actually the patient going into that exam room. The past experiences I've had with providers have created a lot of anxiety for me. Being mispronounced, which is something that still happened to me last year, even though if you saw a picture of me, you would not assign the pronoun she to me. These little microcosms of experiences have made it hard for me to be the advocate all the time, especially mm-hmm. when it's I am the patient. I have a back problem. I'm worried about my back, but I'm also worried about how I'm going to be treated when it gets revealed, if it gets revealed that I'm transgender. And at those moments, I really don't want to be the person that has to do the teachable moments of, well, let me educate on you on this. I really want to be able to have my back taken care of.
Right. Let me share this email from one of our listeners, Slayton, before we close this hour. Slayton emailed us writing, last year when I went to my primary care provider in rural Iowa about going on to an HIV prevention medication after hearing about it on Iowa Public Radio. He was honest, the doctor was, and had no knowledge about it. However, he provided me with primary research material, which helped me understand the side effects of this medication and its costs compared to my lifestyle, which led me not to go on it at that time. Now, the medication is free to me due to my change in my health insurance. I'll always be grateful, writes Slayton, for his honesty related to his lack of knowledge on the topic of specific LGBT health. So there's an example there of when a doctor, Dr. Deming, says, I don't know, and it's appreciated.
And it's wonderful when doctors are able to say that in a way that's not shaming and to be able to provide the resources and information to the client to help them further have knowledge. So those are definitely instances where we see that as a win.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Deming, we have just a minute or two left. Give us your future, your vision here of in contact with those who came in at the conference, how much we still have to achieve here in this area.
I think that, as I said, not knowing is a good perspective for life. We have learned a lot of knowledge over the course of our lifetime, but we know that there were centuries where the smartest people on Earth would tell you confidently that the world was flat. And I know that there's a whole lot I learned in medical school that is inaccurate, and that as we go through life, this understanding that we don't know everything and constantly are learning is a necessary attribute of being human. I would say that one of the most important aspects of being a physician is to be able to be compassionate to patients, to be accepting, understanding, and empathetic, and that no matter where the patient is coming from, that's an important attribute that affects outcomes, it affects patient satisfaction, and it affects the overall healthcare system. William Osler, a famous physician and educator, said, the good physician is the one who takes care of the disease. The great physician is the one who takes care of the patient.
Okay, let's leave you with one more thought, experience from a listener here before we close the show. Kristen writing us, one way that this impacts me is that every first conversation with a medical provider involves a discussion of birth control, a series of questions that I can see leads to the final question of, you're of childbearing age and you're sexually active. Why aren't you on birth control? Now, I've been through this a couple of times. I know the answer, the first of the series of questions with, it's not applicable. No risk of accidental pregnancy. I'm in a long-term lesbian relationship. I've been pleasantly surprised to find that once we get that conversation over with, the nurses and doctors are good to work with and cognizant of any other issues that are impacted by sexual orientation. So we'll leave it with that and thank our guests, Dr. Richard Deming, director of the Mercy Cancer Medical Center in Des Moines. Also, Ryan Salins, an activist in the transgender community, both participants in last weekend's conference. Dr. Deming, Ryan Salins, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. Politics Day tomorrow. Of course, some states weighing in today in the primary. We'll have analysis of that tomorrow. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.